One Thing in Common events, as they're called, a couple of years ago, and we invite people with all kinds of different stories to the barge. I think we've had, in the last 6 months of a year, we've had an ex-terrorist, we've had a bank CEO, a professional athlete before that, so we get all kinds of different people. The one thing they have in common is their faith in God, hence the arrow that pointing upwards to God, and we therefore interview them about their faith and the one thing that they all have in common, and then they do a little presentation at the end. I'm very glad today we've got a soldier, an old friend of mine, Tom Simpson, who's come up to be with us from Oxford today, and Tom, because it's Remembrance, is going to speak about at the end about his experience and the questions of God and justice on the battlefield. But first, I'm going to invite you up and interview Tom. So, Tom, do you come up? Do you have a seat that you clicked on?
I think so, yeah. Can everyone hear? Great.
Now, Tom, when I knew you, you weren't yet a soldier, you were a student, but as soon as you could after uni, you signed up with the Royal Marines. Quite an unusual thing to do for Cambridge's top philosophy graduate. What pushed you in that direction? Why military?
So I think at that stage I was already debating whether I should be an academic in the long term, or indeed whether I should work in a church context in the long term. Both of those, it's not always the case, sadly, for academic philosophy, but you should be trying to say something significant about life. And I suppose there's a bit of me that thought if you live in the ivory tower all your life, you lose some perspectives that would be valuable. So I want to do something different. I thought, well, I've got 4 or 5 years, you know, I'll do something I enjoy. And I'd always enjoyed being outdoors, enjoyed being active, enjoyed the company of other men. And actually, I thought the soldiering was really attractive to me. So that was what led me to do it for the time that I did.
Okay, so you went then into training, which I think was a year or so. And you
13 months.
Something called the Sword of Honour I read about, which is for the top recruit. Tell us about what you have to do. What is the sword? Do you literally have somewhere on your mantelpiece or something?
So I do have a sword. It's in a cupboard. My wife's not so excited about my military background. I thought it was a real kind of coup, but it's rusting in a cupboard. If finances get really tight, it's worth a grand, so I could sell it. So I'm constructing an outdoor shed, and then all my photos and the sword may inhabit my cave. I had to do well in training, obviously, and it was the top performing young officer in training.
And then they sent you off to various places. Where is it that you've toured and served?
So I served in Northern Ireland for 6 months in 2004, which obviously was mostly a quiet time. I think I had rocks thrown at me once, so pretty benign. And by teenagers, and I had 15 Royal Marines in body armour and rifles around me. Then I served in Iraq, in Baghdad, for 6 months in 2006, and then in the winter of 2006, 2007, I was in Afghanistan with 3 Commando Brigade, which was the summer of 2006 that the first casualties started coming back, and it really hit the public consciousness that Britain was engaged in operations there, and we were the immediate follow-on tour that winter.
So some pretty feisty areas, and folks that you trained with will have been casualties in that. So it's, I guess, difficult questions for you, and we're going to hear a little bit about that later on, so I won't press you on that now. Those do provide questions for faith. You had faith before then, and when we knew each other. Just outline how it is that you came to have a convinced Christian faith in the first place.
Sure. So I, both my parents are Christians, and I was very grateful to them for the real grounding in what it is to follow Jesus that they gave me. But obviously there's a point of transition. So when I was 10 years old, it was largely my parents' faith. I'd inherited it. And then when I was 18, I'd made the transition for myself to really take it on. And I think, hopefully we become more rounded people as we grow up. But certainly as a teenager, probably slightly on the autistic spectrum, reason was tremendously important to me, which indeed it still is, being a philosopher. And so right at the heart of it for me then was questions around truth. Is Christianity, are there reasons to believe that God exists, that he revealed himself in Jesus Christ, and that by knowing him, we can inherit eternal life? And I wrestled with those questions. I really explored them during that time. And I suppose I came to a firm conviction that indeed it was true. And that then provides the base, because it's more than just truth, obviously. There's daily life, and there's living life as a disciple, following Jesus. And I think experiencing the presence of God in your life is tremendously important and integral to that.
Yeah. So you were saying you looked into it. I know that you read the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita. You do things properly when you look into things. And what was it, just for some of us for whom this is brand new, what is persuasive about the Christian faith for you? What was it that kind of gripped you and said, yes, this is true?
So the whole thing about Christianity hangs on Jesus. So if Jesus isn't who he says he is, the whole thing is nonsense and doesn't deserve to be taken at all seriously. And right at the heart of it are these accounts of Jesus' life on earth. And as you read them, you encounter the person of Jesus Christ. You see the life he lived, the claims that he made about himself, the death he died, and then the transformation of the early church of his first friends who knew him. And you're kind of, so there's a, in theoretical terms, there's a question of how can I explain what's going on here? And that is a real, so there's a question of, I've got the evidence, what is the best explanation for it? But in some sense, even before that is a kind of question of personal encounter. So when you meet someone, you think for yourself, do I trust this person? What are the reasons that I have to trust this person? And a lot of that actually happens sort of subconsciously. You're thinking, are they a person of integrity? Can I take what they say seriously? And with force, as I read the accounts of Jesus' life, I'm forced to confront that question for myself. What do I make of his claims? Do I think he's lying? Do I think he's telling the truth? Or do I think he's cracked in the head? And I thought the second was the case.
Yeah. Great. So since leaving, you're not now in serving the Royal Marines. You're a professor of philosophy in public policy in Oxford. So the two worlds you know best, military world and an academic world, they're both typically not always easy places to be a person of faith. What have been the challenges for you, maybe in both of those?
So the military, maybe I'll speak briefly to the military person and then philosophy. So the military, a lot of people, their first question to me is, how can you be a Christian and train to kill and go on operations? How does that fit with loving your neighbour? And there is a serious question there. I don't want to duck it, but I'd actually wrestled with that beforehand and come to my resolution on that. Actually, the far harder issue was a question of identity and loyalty. So, the military kind of claims your whole life, and when you train and go through the tests for the Green Beret, there's a deep desire to succeed and pass the tests, both in a literal and metaphorical level. And alongside that comes a very clear image of what kind of the good Royal Marine looks like. And there's a square jaw and a buff physique. And Royal Marines train hard and they play hard. And the play hard probably doesn't need me to tell you that it involves a lot of drink and enjoying meeting lovely young women. That's a kind of integral part to the whole process. So for me, actually, the biggest challenges were those kind of lifestyle factors. Where is my life distinctive? Am I going to say that following Jesus comes first? And along with that, am I prepared to say that actually, although I want to do my job really, really well, and I want to not just do my job, but be a Royal Marine, actually, that's secondary. Ultimately, it's always secondary to who I am at the heart, which is someone who's been transformed by the love of Christ.
Yeah. And going on the high table
academy. Right, yeah. So, I mean, to the academy in some sense, the reductive version is peer pressure, isn't it? You know, there's a community who just look at things very, very differently to you. And there's no doubt that in the academy, there's a prevailing way of looking at the world, which both intellectually and sort of socially has cut loose from its original moorings, which is in the context of Christian belief. I mean, that's the historical source of Western academia. And the challenge there is the kind of is both the drip, drip, drip of a different way of looking at the world, which I am which I believe is false, and which I'm called to articulate the reasons for, and remaining bold and steadfast in speaking publicly and saying this is there's a different way of looking at the world, and here are the reasons for it.
Okay, I guess there'll be some of us in this room who are just slightly surprised that you exist.
Thank my parents, yeah.
You know, believe the Bible, believe in Jesus, and yet haven't thrown away their brains. That in itself, you know, you may be a museum piece for some people. What would you say to someone who's coming in slightly perplexed and thinking, how can you, you know, be a thinking person and a believer?
I'd love to come back and just give a talk on that as well, but the history of our Western intellectual history is grounded and rooted in a deep understanding that the world was created by God and therefore it's comprehensible, it's understandable. And the origins of natural science, you know, physics, chemistry, etc., are themselves deeply tied with a particular theological convictions about the necessity of testing our fallen and fallible ways of understanding the world with objective measurement. That fundamental shift from subjective perception to objective measurement was theologically grounded in the start. And you don't need to be a Christian to do natural science. Clearly, the activity kind of carries on by itself. But the intellectual framework within which it takes place originally was theistic. And indeed, there's a deep and unsolved question as to why you should expect the world to be comprehensible to rational investigation if you're not committed to some kind of deep structural ordering of the universe. And that's a question that you don't hear discussed because it's really uncomfortable for a contemporary naturalistic worldview, but it's a really important one. Just speaking within my discipline, you know, so if you study A-level now, what you have is a kind of selected, edited highlights of great dead thinkers from the past who articulated what has become the dominant intellectual paradigm. So I'm thinking here of Aristotle or David Hume or Nietzsche, who are giving very naturalistic believing that the world, all that exists in the world, is the natural reality of atoms bouncing around in the void, that there's nothing else. And that's an incredibly selective history that's now becoming the kind of the standard story. Descartes, Locke, Berkeley, Leibniz, Kant, all of these guys have got deep, either Christian or theistic commitments right at the front and centre of their work. So it's an extremely selective reading of the history, and that in and of itself, I think, suggests, I've not yet given a strong argument, I've just given a kind of historical argument for the compatibility of the intellectual life and being a Christian.
It does sound like a big topic for another day, but we have to advertise to come back, maybe. So thank you. We are going to now hear from you. You're going to do a presentation for us, and we're looking forward to that. So I'm going to sit down, and we're looking forward to hearing from you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Andy. And just to say, it's a real pleasure to be here and to be able to speak about some of these questions, which are ones that now it feels annually, you know, we're forced to confront, and both as British troops remain engaged in different parts of the world. It's a very live question for our society, I think. So what I'm just going to do is say a little bit about a bit of my experience when I was in Baghdad, and I'm going to use that to just reflect on I think some of the deeper questions around life that the military throws up. So, you know, I don't want to pretend to be a war hero. I served, but the risks that I faced were not nearly as serious as those that others have and did. And but I did. One of the more interesting times I had was in Baghdad. I was what's called the aide-de-camp to a general. So I was his bag carrier. The kind of quid pro quo there is that I do a really boring job and I get to see some very, very interesting things. So he had a national remit. And in particular, one of the north of the country around Mosul, which clearly is now in a very different context, we were doing some sort of soft PR. So we spent 2 weeks inviting a TV filmmaker to go and explore, try and find the final battlefield that Alexander the Great had fought on and defeated Darius the Persian. So we're doing kind of Indiana Jones. We had metal detectors in a war zone. Like, it's really fun. It's really weird. So I had 2 weeks. I had what's called a striker platoon. So striker's a big, you know, it looked like a tank for the uneducated. It's sort of eight wheels, big RPG cages around the outset. And we were given them to drive around the province. They're based in Mosul, and we go around and try and find this battlefield. And we think we did find it. It was a fascinating time. And you can look it up on the Discovery Channel if you're interested. And Tony was the platoon commander of the platoon that was attached to us. And his vehicle had been blown up 3 times in the previous month. He'd obviously survived all of those. He had, we're issued with sort of ballistic proof glasses like Oakley's, which kind of wrap arounds which go along there to protect you. He had a piece of shrapnel that size embedded on his right eye. So those glasses had literally saved his life. And we just had a fascinating time. And anyway, at the end of the 2 weeks, we flew back to Baghdad. And my boss was the 3-star. He was the deputy commander to the American 4-star, who commanded the entire coalition operations in Iraq. So he was one of the 3 3-stars who were the kind of core consultation figures for the future of strategy at the time. This was in 2006, so it was in the lead-up to the surge. Now, the situation in 2006 was really desperate, and things were getting steadily worse and worse. And in particular, there'd been a blowing up of what was called the Golden Mosque in Najaf, which had been the trigger for some really serious Sunni-Shia violence within Baghdad. And we knew that we desperately needed more troops. Casey, the general, was very clear on that. But the difficulty is to generate more troops to close down the kind of the violence that was just literally tearing the country apart. To generate more troops from continental US takes about a 4 or 5 month period. You know, you've got to give guys warning orders, they've got to go through the training package, they've got to come out. So it takes a long time to generate the extra troops. The quickest way to generate the extra troops is to accept the incoming reinforcements and then delay the relief in place that was going to happen. And so we flew back, and there in my boss's inbox was the email saying, here's my proposal, we take the 172nd Striker Brigade and we bring them down to Baghdad. They were 9 days from the end of their tour when that happened. So they'd done a 12-month tour, they'd lost sort of 10, 15 soldiers in the battalion, something in that order, and with 10 days to go they were told, you need to come down and do another 3 months in Baghdad. And that's what they did. And two, three weeks later, we got the first email which said, this unit of the 172nd were involved in an incident and 3 of the guys were killed. So they weren't the only ones. Those were guys who had been expecting to go back to Alaska where they were based, and their wives, their girlfriends, their parents thought they were coming back, and they didn't. And I think we know that war's a pretty bloody affair. And the question that we ask ourselves is this all meaningless? Is there any justice to be found on the battlefield? And I just want to sort of segue across. So this issue is not a new one. I just want to see what being a Christian has to say to this issue that was confronted then and is continuing to be confronted now. And the issue is not a new one. So a passage that was very important to me during this time was from a book called Jeremiah. It's a prophecy from the Old Testament. And Jeremiah is based in the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom of Israel had already been overtaken by the Assyrians with great loss of life. And he was looking forward to a time when the southern kingdom would be overtaken by the Babylonians. And I think it's on the cards that maybe will be given out at the end or that you have. And he looks forward, he says, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider and call for the mourning women to come. Send for the skillful women to come. Let them make haste and raise a wailing over us, that our eyes may run down with tears and our eyelids flow with water. For a sound of wailing is heard from Zion. How we are ruined. We are utterly shamed because we've left the land. They've cast down our dwellings. And I'll just skip forward to verse 21. Death has come up into our windows. It has entered our palaces, cutting off the children from the streets and the young men from the squares. Speak, thus declares the Lord, the dead bodies of men shall fall like dung upon the open fields, like sheaves after the reaper, and none shall gather them. So there, the time when dead bodies lie like cut corn in the open field has happened before. And my suggestion and the conclusion that Jeremiah comes to is it forced us to confront what we actually put our trust in, what counts for us in our lives. And he carries on. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom. Let not the strong man boast in his strength. Let not the rich man boast in his riches. But let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in earth, on earth, for in these I delight. And there are three goods there, which are good things, which he says, in the time of death, these don't count. You can't boast in them. And I can speak to, I hope, two of those. I've never been rich, at least not by British standards. But I do hang out with people who think they're pretty strong, and indeed they are by human standards, and by people who think they're pretty wise, and indeed they are by human standards. But what really counts, what Jeremiah says and what my experience has been, is that knowing the Lord is what counts. Let me just make three comments about the other two. Firstly, they're positional, what economists call positional. Whether you have them depends on what other people not having them. They're uncertain. You don't know whether you're going to get them. And my experience is that they sour on the tongue. That if that's all you have to put your hope in, they sour on the tongue. And there is something else that he offers. So he looks forward. He looks forward to a time. He goes on, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I'll punish all those who are circumcised merely in the flesh. For all of these nations are uncircumcised, and all the house of Israel is uncircumcised in heart. So what's going on there? Okay, so circumcision. So it's a slightly painful operation. Very glad that I haven't had to go through it. But it's a sign of membership. And Jeremiah is looking forward to a sign of membership that people will possess when they belong to the Lord, when the law is written on their hearts through the Holy Spirit, which comes as you put your faith and commit yourself to following Jesus Christ. So there's a hope of resurrection which counts ultimately. And let me just, I just want to conclude. So I want to return to the question of justice on the battlefield, if I may. You may have just caught it there. There's a declaration that the Lord gives about his character. He says, I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness on the earth. So there is a temptation sometimes to think that Christianity is just about pie in the sky when you die. It is, but it's not only that. There is also meat on the plate while you wait. And the Lord works for justice here on earth. And there's a tension here that we don't see the full instantiation of the Lord's justice. And there's an assurance that we will one day. But in the meantime, we work, we look for, we watch, and we wait for the Lord's justice. And that's really just what I want to conclude. I want to say that it is fallible, it's very fragile when we take it into our own hands to seek to be that justice here on earth. But it is in some sense the only option we have. And I want to say that deaths on the battlefield in pursuit of a just cause and by soldiers who fight honourably and justly, those are not vain deaths because they're seeking something that is of value, namely that justice. So what does it take to know God? I've just been gesturing at it. I've been touching on it at times through the brief discussion earlier in this. It's knowing Jesus Christ. That's the Christian claim, that in Jesus Christ, God the Father is revealed fully and completely. And just for reasons of time, I'm going to finish here. But I think, I know the church runs courses, Christianity Explored, where you can explore these questions in more detail. And my invitation, my encouragement, is to consider those as ways that you can go further with these questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming, Tom. It's been a brief time, this lunchtime. Probably questions have arisen for you. And unfortunately, Tom's not going to be around for catching those questions now because he's going to go over to the other side of the water and do something very similar over there. But he did mention we do this thing called Christianity Explored. It's a 4-Monday lunchtime where people can bring any kinds of questions. We look at the source documents for Christianity, and it's a DVD-based presentation. So if you're at all interested in that, can I encourage you to tick the box on the sheets that you were given, and you'll receive an email with details. We also, on the sheets that you've got there, have got details of our carol services coming up next month. They're brilliant events with choir, Marlborough Mythifiers. I'd really encourage you to put that in your diary. And every week here on Wednesday and Thursday, we have lunchtime talks. We're just starting a new series next week. Details about that as well on your card. So if you'd like a weekly email knowing what's going on each week, do tick the box. But whatever it is that you come back to, I hope to see you very soon on the barge. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Andrew. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you.